Good morning, good evening, depending upon what part of the world you're in. If it's Friday, you know, it is the CEO series where we bring together innovative global leaders from across the globe to talk about their successes, detours, as well as learnings as a result of that. Our guest today is a good friend. We haven't seen each other in a while, but we're still good buddies. It's Todd Churches, who's the CEO and co-founder of Big Blue Gumball, an innovative New York City-based management consulting firm specializing in leadership development, executive coaching, three times award-winning adjunct professor of leadership at New York University, as well as a lecturer of leadership at Columbia University. His new book, bestseller, is Visual Leadership, Leveraging the Power of Visual Thinking in Leadership and Life. He's ranked amongst Marshall Goldsmith's prestigious 100 coaches. He's ranked as one of the top 50 thought leaders and influencers in the world by Thinkers360, as well as the Powerless 200, and was one of the global finalists for the 2021 Thinkers360 Distinguished Achievement Award in Leadership. Impressive.
Thank you, Ron. Yeah, Todd, a long way since when we first met. I don't remember how we met, but it was about 20 years ago. So, yeah.
But I've always followed your career. And, you know, when we met, you were at the tail end of the corporate side and you moved into client consulting and you basically grown that. So I always like to start the conversation. You know, take us back to the beginning of your career and just walk us up that mountain as much as you can with the time allowed it. And you went from a key executive in corporate to one of the top leaders in leadership development. That's cool.
Thanks, Ron. Yeah, in my TEDx talk on the power of visual thinking, I opened with talking about how when I was a kid, people would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would say, Superman. I said, all right, well, if you can't be Superman because that job's already taken, what's your backup plan? I said, all right, Batman, right? So those are my two career aspirations as a kid. But what I realized later on, what I really wanted was to work in television in some capacity because I was obsessed. You know, as a baby boomer, Gen Xer, on the borderline. Growing up watching so much television, I just love television. So I started out my career at Ogilvy & Mather Advertising in New York and media buying. And even though it was an interesting job, it wasn't as creative and it wasn't the fun side of TV. So I actually moved out to LA. Having grown up in New York, I moved out to LA after graduating from college and working for a year. And I started working in the television industry. And I worked for Disney. I worked for CBS. Developing TV shows, and then I was in the theme park business for 10 years. So after 10 years in LA, I moved back to New York and got into management leadership development. Later on, started my own company. I got laid off from my last full-time corporate job during the financial crisis.
Okay. Blessing in disguise. Is that correct?
Yeah, things sometimes work out for the best. So yeah, not what you want at the time. But yeah, things happen. And yeah, I always say that my students, I teach in the HR master's program at NYU, it's not a career path, it's a career roller coaster, right? So you got to be, you know, so a career path implies like you're on some stepping stone laid out in a beautiful park, right? It's a roller coaster of ups and downs, twists and turns, highs and lows, and you never know what's coming around the corner. So you really need to be able to ride that. And I hate roller coasters. So this is coming from someone who doesn't like roller coasters. I once rode on the cyclone in Coney Island, and I'm still recovering from that. That was like 30 years ago.
So, you know, so to the ladder to the lattice. So, you were successful in making the pivot. Can you walk through challenges you've had, a detour you've had in trying to make that pivot? Because we were talking earlier, you know, we look at the pyramid. We look at somewhere at the top of the pyramid. But we don't understand the roller coaster rise, the ups and downs. Can you walk us through learnings from those challenges you've had and how you navigated through it?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest transition from corporate to consulting is, when you're working for corporate, you have a paycheck, you have a built-in support network, you have a supervisor, a boss. It's just more structured. And when you work for yourself, you have to create your own structure. You have to be self-disciplined. You need to, you know, you can't just say, oh, I'm going to just coast today. Right? I'm just going to like go in and hang out in the office and talk to people. It's like, then you're wasting a day. So I think that's the biggest transition is needing to be flexible and you need to be proactive. So, it's definitely a different kind of thing in terms of day to day.
So that goes from corporate to entrepreneurship to now a professor inside of the hallowed walls of education. And now I'm imparting all that knowledge back on my students. That's another trajectory. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I've been teaching at NYU for 13 years and Columbia for 11 years, and I still love it. I love my students. I love being in the academic environment. I love teaching. It really was not something I ever set out to do. A friend of mine, Nancy Yankowitz, who's one of the specialists in introverts and presentation skills for introverts, colleague at NYU, she said, you know, let me introduce you to the head of my department at NYU, because you might make a good professor, something I never even envisioned for myself. And then here I am teaching 13 years later. So, even though I talk loud and fast because I'm from New York, I'm an introvert. I always say I'm a 3Bs guy, a back-of-the-room, behind-the-scenes bookworm. So everything I do, talking in front of the room and all the consulting, you know, everything I do is like pushing myself way out of my comfort zone, including like doing a TEDx talk and doing keynotes and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I say you have to push yourself out of your comfort zone and into the zone of the unknown, because you never put it out there once you push yourself. So you know, you always have to, you know, be flexible and adaptable and and try different things. No, you may not succeed at first at all of them.
Yeah, you know, I think of that because I do a lot of public speaking. I always tell people this, oh, you're so good. I said, you should have seen me the first time I got on the stage. It was absolutely awful.
So
that was another area of development that you've kind of transitioned into. So you keep remaking, I don't say what you keep remaking, but you keep making these pivots, you know, in doing that. For someone, and so many people are involved in corporate today and they hate their job. They hate Mondays and coming to work and they're trying to make a decision as to what's next for me. What advice would you give to someone is at that point? But yeah, they could have been laid off. You know, you said I was laid off, but that kind of kicked everything in.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about reflection, introspection, and connection. Reflection is about looking backwards. Introspection is about looking inwards. And connection is about connecting the dots between all the pieces of your life, right? So we need to hit the pause button occasionally and think about, is what I'm doing today where I want to be and what I want to be doing? If not, there's other opportunities, because otherwise you turn around, it's 3 years or 5 years later and you're still doing the same thing. So one of the tools I use that really resonates with my coaching clients and with my students, it's called my passion skill matrix. And it's one of the chapters in my book, little plug for my book, little shout out. So the passion skill matrix, picture a 4-box matrix where you think about, all right, what am I good at from I'm terrible at it to I'm great at it? And what do I like or love to do from I hate it to I love it? And if you map it out in a 4-box matrix, you can see what percentage of time am I spending in my sweet spot, my growth, my default zone, or my failure zone. And the people who are most engaged in their work tend to be above the line in the growth zone and sweet spot. The people who are disengaged or unhappy tend to be below the line, where you're just dialing it in or you're setting yourself up for failure every time. A lot of people get this aha, this epiphany of, no wonder I'm so disengaged or unhappy. I'm spending way too much of my time in the wrong boxes, basically. And the next step is to figure out, all right, how can we get you above the line at least 70 to 80% of your time? Because there's always aspects of all our jobs that we don't love, right? But spending 80% of your time below the line, it's like, no wonder you're not really happy. So just that thought process. I always say, you know, you need to think outside the box, but you can't think outside the box if you have something inside the box. So this helps you to take the complexity and messiness, think compartmentalized, and then say, all right, what, you know, and see things from a new lens. That's one of the ideas behind visual leadership, is seeing the world through a fresh lens.
Okay. So it's kind of like a personal SWOT.
Yeah, in a way. I love that analogy. Definitely. Yes.
Yeah. Kind of like a personal SWOT. And, you know, you mentioned reflection. I think people don't do enough of that. You know, I'm like a reflection person. I reflect every day, at the end of the day, I reflect the end of the week. And I keep going back through that process. But here's a thought. People that may have achieved a certain level, and people, I think social media has kind of created this, because we see people here and we said, I'm not there, but we're not reflecting as to how we could be not there, but someplace else.
Yeah.
So this exercise is a pretty good thought process. What is some feedback that you've gotten from your clients as it relates to this passion skill matrix? Because I've really got to dig into this.
Yeah, it's of all of my different tools. In fact, I hadn't even thought about doing this, but if anyone goes to toddchurches.com/passion, you could download for free that chapter from my book. I forgot it's on there, but it's so anyone who wants that free chapter, you're welcome to download it. One of the things that you just said is about reflection, and there's a saying that we don't learn from experience, we learn from reflection on our experiences, right? So if we don't hit the pause button, if we just race from one thing to the next thing to the next thing, if we don't stop and look back on what worked and what didn't, then we're not going to keep learning, right? Yeah. And I always use the Nelson Mandela quote, I never lose, I either win or I learn. Right.
Okay.
So I love that quote. But we also need to learn from our wins, because otherwise you don't know what you should repeat next time. So I always modify by adding that. But we're all so busy, but you really need to hit the pause button metaphorically and just give some thought to what worked, what didn't. And I always talk about this metaphor, my stop, start, and continue. Right? What do I want to continue doing? What should I stop doing? And what do I need to start doing? Right?
There's no
magic wand. We need to do the work. And if we don't take the time, it's not going to magically happen for us.
Hey Todd, I love you. Got all your props there, man. You're walking us through this, and you're making it look so easy. So basically, what you're saying is that we have to kind of stay in diagnostic mode. Not stay in diagnostic mode, but we have to keep going back and try and figure this out. Because I said this about social media. We see this, and we think I'm not here, but we don't do the reflection to try and get to that path. Is that something that you cover in your book? Because I'm going to come up with your book next.
Yeah, I talk a lot about that, how we learn. I have another four-box matrix. A lot of it is about learning. JFK, the quote I opened my NYU course with, he said that leadership and learning are indispensable to one another. Like, if we don't keep learning as leaders, I would say in an ever-changing world, if we're standing still, we're falling behind, and we're going to become, one more prop, a dinosaur. We do not want to go extinct. I keep this on my desk to remind me we need to continue to be flexible and bend over backwards to serve our clients. I could do this all day long. I know we only have 20 minutes, but unlimited props here. But I mean, my friend, a good friend of mine who I just met for the first time, we've been friends on LinkedIn and Zoom for many years, Eduardo Briceño.
Just
wrote a book called The Performance Paradox. And what he says is, when we're performing, we're not learning, and we're learning, when we're learning, we may not be performing. So we need to set aside the time to do both. Because if we're only trying to get better at something, but we're not learning the skills that it takes to get better at those things, it's not going to happen. And if we're just learning, then we're not putting our ideas into actions to produce results. So just a little shout out to Eduardo, and congrats on his new book that just literally came out a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I saw that post. I'm going to connect with him because I'd love to have him on the show.
So he'd be an amazing guest. He's great.
Yeah. So talk us through, where did visual leadership come from? Because I'm intrigued by the branding of that, because you see leadership, but visual leadership is right away I'm thinking. So what does that look like from a visual perspective? How did that come about? So give us the thinking behind the title of that and what that book explores than a normal leadership development book, which has thousands of them.
Yeah, there's so many. I've been reading an average of one business book a week since 1998. So that's 50-something a year for 25 years. So I've read over 1,300 business books over the years. And I was always quoting other people's books, and people kept saying to me, you know, you need to write your own book because, you know, it's a unique approach. But basically, I was an English literature major as an undergrad. So I think in terms of character and story, and stories have beginnings, middles, and ends, villains, victims, and heroes. There's a quest or a goal. There's obstacles that stand in the way, and there's some resolution, right? So do our lives, right? As leaders, we go through that same character arc, that same leadership journey. So it's rooted in my English literature major and my studies of Shakespeare and poetry and use of metaphor and visual language and all the things showing it. So visual leadership, and if you think about the word leadership, the word vision is the word that comes to mind most often. So what does it mean to have a leadership vision? It's about having a mental picture in your mind's eye of a better future, right? Yeah. Like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, I have a dream. He didn't say, I have a business plan. I have a
a strategy.
At the PowerPoint presentation to show you, right? He said, I have a dream. And what was his dream? It was a vision of a better future, right? Mm. So we need to create a mental movie in the minds of others of what the future could look like, and then get people on board with that vision. And if you look at the title of visual leadership, the fact that most people don't even know this, it's one word with a shared capital L. And this represents the fact that who you are and how you lead is inseparable from the lens through which you see the world, right? Our biases, our assumptions, our backgrounds, our education, our culture, our experiences all shape what we see, but also what we miss, right? So we need to open up our eyes. And I call it flipping the eye. If you see the rainbow colored eye, just as no one in the world has this color eye, no one in the world sees the world through the same lens that you do. So in the spirit of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, we need to flip the eye on ourselves and look inwardly at our belief systems and our biases, and also try to see the world through the lens of others who are leading, so we can help them turn their visions into reality. So that's just a quick summary and overview of what visual leadership is all about.
Okay, let me do a quick shout out to some of our people that follow us every week and watch the show. My good friend, John Self, great line, fabulous wisdom, push yourself out of the comfort zone and into the zone of the unknown. Well, that's cool, that's cool. And then Peter says, absolutely fantastic, this is dead on. And John has been preaching this as well. Wow.
That's great to hear, that's great to hear.
Yeah, so it's
technical. A lot of people are visual leaders, but until I kind of created that brand, they don't think of themselves in that way. So it's just a new way of looking at leadership. And if you picture a Venn diagram, it's the application of visual thinking and visual communication to the practice of management and leadership. So when you combine the two together and you use visual imagery, mental models, metaphor, analogy, and storytelling, then you're visually leading. So that's the whole concept behind it.
Okay, I want to go back to the point you mentioned about everybody was saying you need to do a book, because people keep telling me you need to do a book, you need to do a book. But needing to do a book and getting down to the actual work of doing a book is totally two different things.
Oh, yeah, it's not as easy as it looks. In fact, you know, if you've never done it before, you have no idea even where to start, right? So I'd been kind of working on it for like 15 years, just so I had about 2,000 pages of content accumulated, my models, my stories, and I always encourage everyone to keep a leadership journal, a learning journal, where you write down things that happen to you, questions you have. And it's interesting to look back on your journal years later and to see where you started and what your thought process was at that time. But I went to a leadership conference and I met a guy named Rob Salafia, who wrote the book Leading from Your Best Self. And I said, can you tell me how you got a book published? I literally have no idea. He introduced me to his agent, Ken Lazard. I'm based in New York. He's based in Boston. So even though I'm a Yankees fan and they were Red Sox fans, we found a way to make it work. Ken took me on as a client. We pitched my idea to a number of publishers, and Post Hill Press, Simon & Schuster picked it up. And then that's the scary part, is when they say, okay, let's do it. You have 9 months to deliver a first draft manuscript. All that someday becomes 9 months, right? So that's scary, but I locked myself away for the summer of 2019, and I wrote round the clock and worked with an editor, and we got it done, and it's been amazing.
Okay.
In fact, I started carrying it at the Barnes & Noble in my neighborhood on the Upper East Side in New York, so I stop by all the time. It's still imposter syndrome. I walk into a bookstore, and there I am next to like Peter Drucker and Marshall Goldsmith, like sitting up there. So
yeah, I know it is. But, you know, even with the thought of putting all that together, so you have a background in writing, so you understand that. So what advice would you give to a non-writer, but who has been experienced a lot of things? You say you captured some pieces over the years of learnings and all those kinds of things. What advice would you give to a newbie as it relates to writing a book?
Yeah. The first thing I would say this to my students, the best way to become a better writer is to become a better reader. So read anything, everything, take in new voices, new perspectives. Just the process of reading, you know, basically wires your brain differently. So you start to think in clarity in sentences. And, you know, the hardest part of my book was, here I had 2,000 pages of content, but how do you structure it? How do you, in what order? So that was hard too. But also, you don't have to do it alone. Like, you know, a lot of times people think of writing as a solitary exercise, but it's good if you have collaborators, people you can bounce ideas off of, an experienced editor or someone else who's written who can give you feedback. But my main thing, again, is keep a journal so you can accumulate content. If you sit down to write and you're just staring at a blank piece of paper, blank screen, that's the scariest thing.
Yeah.
That is, I had so much content, I'm like, all right, now I need to sort this out and figure out how do I get content out of my head and then down to, you know, onto the computer so that it can get out there in the form of a book. And there's nothing like that feeling I'm not a parent, so but you can picture, like, you know, holding your kid for the first time, holding the physical book in your hand for the first time. Experience.
I can imagine when that came out, you've got your book. Wow, would I've ever thought that this would have happened? And maybe, oh my God, that feeling must have been monumental.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. So,
and also to get blurbs from people like Marshall Goldsmith and Dan Pink and, you know, some top authors, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty cool when people, you get that stamp of approval. And that's, you know, it's because between my TEDx talk and then my book, that's how I got into Marshall Goldsmith's MG100 Coaches, which is an incredible community of some of the top coaches in the world.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When I'm meeting people like John Baldoni and Chester Elton, these guys, I've been reading their books for 20 years, and now I'm part of this community. It's pretty surreal. And then that led to the Thinkers 50 Award and other things that have happened since then.
So
it's just about, you know, putting stuff out there into the world, even and not expecting it to be perfect, because perfectionism can really hold us back. We need to, as Godin says, we need to ship, right?
Yeah,
at some point, we need to put our stuff out there into the universe and then see what happens.
So that book has been out, how long is that?
My book came out in May of 2020, so it's been a little over 3 years. So it launched just as the pandemic hit. So all of my, you know, you work on this for years, and then all of a sudden you have book signings and everything else scheduled, and it's like, oh, sorry, pandemic, like everyone's go home. So it's like, then I had to like pivot, talk about pivoting. But you know what the flip side of that is? Before the pandemic, I had about 4,000 LinkedIn connections. I now have 13,000. Right.
Mm.
That would not have, and connections all over the world and people reading my book in different parts of the world. That would not have happened if not for the pandemic. So, again, we need to take, you know, we live in, I was talking about, you know, we live in the VUCA world, but volatile, uncertain, complex.
Yeah.
We need to figure out a way to navigate and pivot with when these changes happen. And luckily, things actually worked out for the better rather than for the worse. So,
So let me ask you this. So you talk about, you know, some of the people you've mentioned there. I tend to run into those people in Mumbai every year in February when we have this big award. Marshall is normally there. Chester's been there before. Chester I met in Nigeria. We were working, not working on a project, but he was there as a speaker as well. So that gives that stamp of approval.
Yeah.
And that led to TEDx speaker, which is kind of a, now you're importing for the masses of people.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to, in fact, I had applied to be a TEDx speaker 5 times before and I was rejected every time. In fact, the last time I was rejected, they had 11 finalists. I was one of 11 and they said, oh, sorry, we only have time for 10. And I got cut. But you know what I did? Instead of just sour grapes saying, oh, I don't want to do this, I actually went to the TEDx event, took pictures of myself in front on the red carpet in front of the TEDx sign so I could visualize what it's like to stand on that stage. And then when I was there, the TEDx organizer introduced me to another TEDx organizer, and she said, Todd just got cut. And he said, well, you were the last one on this one, but I'll make you the first one on mine. I had to go through the application process, but so that's how going to that event and meeting the organizer is what resulted in my eventually being chosen to be a TEDx speaker. So that's another example of just putting yourself out there into the world and then seeing what happens. And you never know.
Yeah. Because if you would not have done that, you would not have been able to list that as an accomplishment of being that TEDx speaker. Yeah. So let me ask you, I was talking through this earlier, top 50 thought leaders, influencers in the world. That's heavy.
It's very surreal. You know, again, we met 20 years ago. I was not in that category 20 years ago at all.
But I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming.
You probably had a crystal ball. You should have lent me your crystal ball back then.
But when you think of that, how did that feel? You know, when you get that notification, I've won awards, and you wake up in the morning, you see an award. Oh, okay, cool. And then it's gone. And then you're back to real world and doing that. So walk us through that notification, because top 50 is huge.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, they're all different categories. Like, I'm in the leadership, management, and design thinking categories. So it's cool. It's kind of like the first time I attended one of these events, I always said I feel like a rookie elected to the All-Star team surrounded by Hall of Famers, to use a baseball analogy. And it's like, but it's really what I'm finding is the people in these communities are very generous. I always talk about 4 G's, Be genuine, be generous, be grateful, and be gracious. So, and most of the people in these communities are very generous. And because you would think, oh, with all these people, everyone's trying to compete to be the smartest person in the room. And it's the exact opposite, where people are very supportive. We talk about we're together for learning and community and amplifying each other's work. It's not about being the best or the smartest or who's won more awards or sold more books. So it's really nice to be part of a community that has those four G's. A lot of these communities are very much like that. Because when you work for yourself, you don't have coworkers or colleagues, right? You have to kind of form your de facto family of colleagues that support one another. And as you and I have done over the many years, and as we do on LinkedIn and liking and commenting on each other's posts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I always do that. And someone was saying, so you always post comforting words for people. So I look at this phase as kind of like a cheerleader. I want to cheer everybody on, and I want everybody to do well, because it's not a game of competing. And that's a good point that you mentioned. Help everybody move forward in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, that's that saying. Instead of fighting for a bigger piece of the pie, let's fight together to expand the pie. Right. So that's just, that's a good example of visual leadership, because I just used a mental model, and even using my hand to illustrate it. But everyone can get that, right? Everyone knows what a pie looks like. So that's an example of using visual language. So even if you're not using visual imagery or props or PowerPoint slides or drawing. So one of my Inc. articles for Inc. magazine is called "Can You Draw What Your Company Does?" And anyone could just Google "Can You Draw What Your Company Does" at Inc. and you'll find the article. I talk about, if you had to get up at a whiteboard or a flip chart and actually draw without speaking, what is it that your company does and how are you different from and better than the competition, what would you draw? And even if you suffer from ICD, which is I can't draw syndrome, as I do, if you could play Pictionary and charades, then you could communicate visually, right? So what would you draw if you had to use a metaphor or a mind map or a storyboard or a process diagram? How would you illustrate what it is that you do? And I'm not going to give away the story so anyone can read the article, but that's just one technique I use with my executive coaching clients to help them think through how can I visually explain my idea and my vision? Because my catchphrase is, how do you get people to see what you're saying, right? People are not mind readers, and your vision could be so clear in your head, but yet if people don't do or are not in alignment with your vision, whose fault is that? Is it their fault or is it our fault? It's our job to get other people to see what we're saying.
Okay. So let me flip the switch, so to speak. If you're giving a keynote to an esteemed group of CEOs, what would be some key themes that you would talk to them about the future of work, a new and dynamic, younger workforce? What are some key insights that you would give to them? As a group, I know you do. You do executive coaching, but if you had all of those people in a room, what would be the key?
Yeah, I do executive coaching and teaching, and also keynotes and management leadership training. So I work with groups of one person to 100 or 1,000 people at one time. The key is to see things through a different lens and realize that your perspective is not the one and only perspective, and we need to see things through the lens of others. And I always use this. I keep this on my desk to remind me, we need to open up our minds to create space for new ways of thinking, because if our minds are closed, then we're not going to have a lot of space in there. So this is one of my tangible reminders that we need to, open up our minds and our eyes and our hearts to different ways of looking at the world.
Okay. Did you prep all your props? Because you have everything there.
Visual thinking is the elephant in the room that we are not talking about, Ron.
Okay. So let's flip that and take that back to, they're bringing you in as a keynote to the all hands on meeting, and all the workers are there. Would that message be different? What advice would you give for people that are struggling in a career and they're thinking about making a change, or they're trying to find themselves in some way? Yeah. What would that audience message look like?
Yeah. I mean, you've gotten bits and pieces of it today about seeing things through a new lens, about realizing that you don't have to have all the answers, about creating a community around you, about taking the time for reflection, about trying and being willing to fail. I keep this on my desk, learn something new every day, be a continuous learner and reader. So that's what I would say. It's just, no matter where you are in your career, even if you're late career, you could still be learning and trying new things. You know, everyone's, no one knows like what AI is going to, how that's going to impact, right?
No,
Everyone's just trying to figure it out. And if I had a headline, the focus of my work over the last few years, it's managing and leading in a post-pandemic hybrid world. The whole battle between return to office and work from home versus hybrid. It's like, how do we figure out a way to meet the organization's needs and the needs of a diverse employee population, right? So there's no one-size-fits-all way of doing this. So we need to be more flexible and we need to be better listeners, right? Not just better speakers, but better listeners as well. Because you can learn a lot from listening, and a lot of times leaders need to feel like they have to figure it all out on their own, as opposed to saying, you know, they say as a team, together everyone achieves more. So we need to, like, you know, leverage the brain, collective brain power of a diverse population, and say, all right, we're, you know, Jim Collins of Good to Great talks about getting the right people on the bus and in the right seats and the wrong people off. I love that metaphor because that's what we need to do as leaders, is to reevaluate occasionally who's on our bus and are they in the right seats and where are we going to take it, and let's figure that out together.
Yeah, you mentioned listening as a key competency for this new level of leaders and need to listen more. I see messages and statements from senior leaders and saying we need to do this. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, where did you get that from? Yeah. Where did you say, well, I need everybody to come back to work 5 days a week? Where did you get that from?
Yeah, it's not just because, you know, here in New York, a lot of leaders are bringing people back to work just because they have vacant office space. That is not the reason to bring people back to office. The people are coming into the office and spending all day on Zoom and then just going home and they didn't talk to anyone. You can understand why they didn't want to commute 2 hours from Long Island into Manhattan to sit at a desk with headsets on all day, right? Yeah. So there's got to be a strategic purpose behind these decisions, because, you know, again, the dinosaur, we can't turn the calendar back to 2019 and pretend the last few years never happened. So we really need to see things through in a different way and be a better listener and also listening with empathy and compassion. It's not just listening to the words, but listening to the feelings behind the words. So I would say facts, figures, and feelings. People are motivated by feelings, not facts and figures. So you really need to think about what are people actually feeling. And then, you know, and focusing on the why. So we need to be, here's one more. We need to be extra curious. We need to be extra curious and ask questions about what people are thinking and feeling and the why behind it. So we can, again, come up with better solutions.
I like the why, because I'm a big fan of the book that Simon Sinek wrote about always start with why. Mm-hmm. So can you explain to me why? So when I look at companies are saying we need to be back into the office, give me a better version of why than saying, you know, I keep hearing this water cooler conversation and all these kind of things. And I've worked in corporate offices and I don't really get that from the water cooler metaphor, but can you explain the why better? And I think leaders need to understand that the workforce's dynamic is totally different. Mm-hmm. And we have to do a better job of, because you mentioned the coming in and I'm on Zoom all day. I could have done this from home.
Yeah, you have to, you know, just saying, you know, we have free pizza every day is not an enticement to come to work, right?
Yeah.
And also, so again, this is the thing. There's no one size fits all anything, right? It depends on your industry, your company, your culture, your role. You know, as leaders, like if you're working from home, but you're telling all your people to go to the office, you're not modeling the behavior, right? Yeah. You also need to create a reason, a way for collaborate. People to collaborate. And again, it's really, I would say the answer to every question is it depends, right? It's not a cop-out. It's about figuring what it depends on, right? So when we make these decisions, it's got to be with strategic. It's got to be with intent. It's got to be with purpose. Because otherwise, you're going to lose a lot of talented people. There's a friend of a friend who just quit a job after 8 years that she was that she loved and was successful at because the company ordered back everyone within 50 miles had to work, come in the office, everyone beyond. But what if you lived at 51? Or if you're at 49, do you have to pack up and move so you can be two miles outside that radius? It's like, you're not making business decisions when you do that. You're just trying to herd cats and just like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But see, I think of a situation like that, and I'm wondering who was that filtered through? Where was the HR department, the people, so-called people experts in trying to drive a directive just like that?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a recent article and I talked about the concept of adult to adult relationship, which is the new normal. versus adult to child. That adult to child that said, you'll do this and you will come in. That's right. Over with.
Yeah.
So when I asked you the question about the advice you'd give to leaders and listening, I don't think they're doing a good job of listening, because when I look at these statements saying we need everybody back to work because we can collaborate better or whatever it is, that's not really a selling point. You mentioned free pizza. I can get pizza.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't have to commute 2 hours and pay, you know, $50 and put on a suit and tie for a slice of pizza. Right? I could get that for $2 at my local pizza. So there's gotta be more to it than that. So, again, so we're not saying everyone needs to work from, also, you know, it really depends on where you are in your career. You know, there's so many, you know, also, you know, are you taking care of children or aging parents? Do you have other obligations? So again, you can't just put people in a box or a bucket and say, all right, everyone needs to do this on these days or work these hours. So we need to be more flexible. Otherwise, we're going to lose more people, or we're going to demotivate people, and people are going to be less engaged. So, like, for example, there's some people who would prefer to come back to the office, right? Yeah. So, like, for example, my friend's daughter graduated from college during the pandemic. She's had 4 different jobs, but has never met a human being in any of these companies because she's always worked from home. First at her parents' house and now in her apartment. But so is she missing out on learning, you know, by sitting next to someone else and the apprenticeship model and just the human contact and the socialization? So, you know, but someone who's been doing this for 30 years, you may not need that same, you know, let's go out after work for drinks kind of atmosphere. So again, it really depends on where you live. It depends on all these different factors that need to be taken into consideration. So
a good buddy of mine, Steve Slosh, you may know Steve. He was the CHRO from the U.S. Golf Association.
Yes, I know Steve.
Steve is a very good friend. So he and I, we always do a yearly lunch. And I was talking to him about that. I said, you know what I miss when I come to, I miss the commute, you know, driving again and the training, and I'm going through this and I'm kind of romanticized. He said, stop it. He said, it wasn't all that.
Yeah.
And the more I think about it, if I had to drive, because I live in Jersey, drive to Willowbrook Mall to get on a bus or drive to get on a train, sounded cool. But I look at it now, I can do whatever I need to do from my house.
Yeah.
In my office at my house.
Yeah. That's why, like, you know, people don't need to be managed. They need to be led, right? So we need to figure out, how do we lead people, you know, and meet them where they live, right? So not, you know, geographically and physically, but just where they are in their lives, and say, all right, how can we make this work best for both of us, right? So sometimes, you know, if you do need to come in the office, it's not just an arbitrary, you know, everyone in the office 2 days a week or three. That's just a random number. There needs to be a strategic purpose. What's gonna happen on those days? You can't just hope for those water cooler conversations. You need to facilitate interactions and help people to connect and build those bonds and everything else. So as leaders, we need to be a little more intentional and proactive and saying, if we're going to make people come into the office, there's got to be some, you know, result that comes from that, and not just checking that. All right, you checked that box 3 times this week. So that's not what, you know, like you said, treat people like adults and not like, you know, children. And and also there's that issue of proximity bias, right? Do we give preferential treatment and promotions to the people who come into the office who are sitting right next to us versus the people who are not? So I always talk about 3 V's: visibility, voice, and value. That's about, are you seen, are you heard, and are you contributing and being recognized for those contributions? And that could come whether you're remote or whether you're in person. You still need to be seen, heard, and contribute, regardless of where you're physically located.
Okay, cool. So in closing, I wanted to ask you a question. Is that one of the key reasons that we started this program, because we wanted to leaders to share their stories. And we try and choose people who've had amazing careers, and they've started from here and they've ended up here. But we talk about the trajectory and how do you get there, the failures and detours. And this is what we talk about, the career journey. So I want to tell you today, you brought out our mission is what we're trying to accomplish. And we hope that you enjoyed being a guest on the show. Are there any takeaways that you want to give to the audience as a result of being on the show or sharing your insights?
Well, first of all, you're a master of, you know, not only HR, but of leadership. So you are a visual leader from way back. So, I just enjoyed the conversation. Like you said, it's like having a cup of coffee, only we're, you know, across the pond. I know you're in London, I'm in New York today. So, but it's important to keep, again, take the time to reflect and to have these conversations and listen to these conversations, watch TED Talks, listen to podcasts, read books. you know, if we don't keep learning and we have to see things from multiple perspectives, because it's so, again, the longer you've been doing this, the easier it is to just get set in stone, but yeah. then you atrophy and then you die, right? So it's like, you don't want to be that dinosaur I was holding up before. So we need to think about, you know, how do we keep things fresh and current and keep our energy up. One of my acronyms is educate, engage, and excite, right? Educate is what you want to learn. Engage is how you're going to capture people's attention and engage with other people. And excite is how do you keep your motivation and your morale up? Because if you don't have that high energy, you're either an energizer or you're an energized drainer, energy drainer, right? So you're sucking the air out of people, or are you inspiring them, right?
That's Duracell, right? Is that the Duracell ad?
So we gotta keep it moving, gotta keep that energy up. And last thing, my last metaphor that I use a lot is, what is your leadership weather report today? Are you a cloud of doom and gloom, or are you a ray of sunshine who lights up the room, right? So a lot of leaders, we're all stressed, we're all anxious, we're all on overload and overwhelm. But if that's our attitude and we're like thunder, lightning, and clouds, are people gonna feel that oppression and they're not gonna innovate, they're not gonna, be energized. But if you're a ray of sunshine and you can be positive even in difficult times, that is how you motivate and inspire other people. So just think about, if you're walking in and people are opening up their umbrellas, you know that you're that cloud of gloom and gloom. So be that ray of sunshine who lights up the room even on Zoom, right? So you have to do that even remotely.
I think I see the second book. I think I'm here.
To enjoy this one, right? So
Right.
But that is in my book. What's your leadership weather report today is one of the chapters in my book.
Okay, cool. John Self, who's my friend from Texas, Guiding Your Career, is his podcast. You should listen to that. He's a great program, inspiration. He just bought your book.
Oh, thank you, John.
So cool. We got one sale in the till. So that's
all right.
Cool.
Happy to connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to chat with you and learn more about you, John. So
he would. Matter of fact, he would be. But you would be a great guest on his show because he does the same show. So you two connect and take it from there. So from London, I'm saying take care. And
thank you, Ryan.
I'll see you when I get back to New York, and we can do a physical thing and connect.
That would be great. Thank you, Ron.
Okay, man. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.